Peter once tried to hide the fact that he followed Jesus. Despite repeated accusations that he had been seen with Jesus, he denied the truth. Yet one servant called his bluff, pointing out, "Surely you are one of them." Take a look at Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, and in verse 73. Matthew 27, and I think I miswrote that verse. 163. And says, "Sir, we remembered that when he was still alive, that deceiver said after..." Oops. I'm on 26. Right? Yes, 26, verse 73. Sorry about that. "A little later, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, 'Surely you too are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away.'" That's an interesting phrase. That's an interesting point that's being made. "Surely your speech betrays you." What is it about the way we talk that lets people know about our character and who we are? We don't often think about the small things. And that's oftentimes why the small things reveal themselves about, and ourselves about them to other people. In fact, Jesus pointed out that if you want to know somebody, look at what they do. Take a look at Matthew chapter 7 and in verse 16. Matthew 7, starting with verse 16, it says, "You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then, you will know them by their fruits." How do you know what a person's like? Watch what they do. Watch what they say when they're not really thinking about trying to impress you. So often I get questions from people that say, start out saying, "Well, I'm a Christian," or "I'm a believer," or "I go to church." But then they're followed by a situation where they describe a very un-Christ-like behavior. And I often wonder why there's such a disconnect between what a person claims to be and how they actually act. Take a look at John chapter 14. John chapter 14, and starting with verse 23. John 14 and verse 23. Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words. And the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father who sent me." How we are, who we are, ought to permeate every aspect of our lives. And it should be seen in the small things that we do, the words that we might pick when we say things we're not really thinking about. Everything ought to reflect who we are, and that who we are ought to be a follower of Christ. But I want you to take a look at some stories that you're probably familiar with in the Old Testament, as well as we'll get to a few in the New Testament, where we might see how a person's speech betrays them. Take a look at 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 25. There's a man named Nabal, whom David runs across. And in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, starting with verse 2, it says, "Now there was a man in Moab whose business was in Carmel. And the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about that while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and visit Nabal, and greet him in my name, and thus you shall say, have a long life, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I've heard that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days that they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David." David had been doing Nabal a favor. Not that he was particularly asked to do this. It was done completely without being asked. He had been giving Nabal's flocks and his shepherds protection, which is no small matter, especially in the days that these were occurring. And a feast day was coming up, and David basically asked if he and his men might join Nabal for a meal, or that Nabal might send some food on that day. Considering what David has been doing, extremely small payment for what David and his men had done. But I want you to notice Nabal's response. I'm going to start with verse 9. When David's men, young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all the words in David's name, and they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" So David's young men retraced their way back, and when they came back, told him according to all these words. Notice how many times Nabal talks about me in that, just that one little statement. He basically says only a couple sentences, but I and my come out loud and clear. It's not that Nabal doesn't know who David is. He even knows who his father is. Nabal's not saying that David's a stranger. Nabal is actually insulting David. But notice the pride that's being displayed. So what kind of man, other than the scriptures already told you he was evil, what kind of man is he? When he answers and says, "About me, mine." His character shines right through, doesn't it? He's quite a selfish man. Now, David's own pride was wounded, and he planned revenge, starting in verse 21 of that same chapter. Now, David said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all this that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. May God do to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male, any who belong to him." David was going to wipe him out because of the insult. But Nabal's wife, Abigail, intervened and helped David to see that by taking revenge, he basically fighting evil with evil. Nabal's full of himself. He thinks himself as being the top person, and the whole world revolves around himself. If David took revenge, he'd be displaying the same type of character. And so in chapter 25 and verse 28, it says, "Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil will not be found in you all your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of the sling. And when the Lord does for my Lord according to all the good he has spoken concerning you, and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause, and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. They should say, let God handle this. Now she is pleading for her own husband, but she has a point. You can't fight evil with evil. David was rightly angered. But God did take care of the matter. Starting with verse 36, and Abigail went to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became like a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. She waited until after he got done with the feast, and then told him how close he came to death. And the Lord struck him. Almost an irony, he almost died basically at the very feast that he was claiming was all his and belonged to him alone. But we got to think about when we see that. Look how much time people spend talking about themselves. Take a look at another character in the Old Testament, Sennacherib. Sennacherib is king of Assyria, a nation that's been around for like 3,000 years about this time. And in Isaiah chapter 36, Assyria has invaded Judah, is surrounded Jerusalem, and is about to plan on an attack, and he basically is trying to undermine their confidence. And in Isaiah 36, starting with verse 14, it says, thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. The city is not given into the hands of the king of Syria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, come out to me, and eat each of his vine, and each of his fig, and drink of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take your land away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and of new wine, and a land of bread and of vineyards. Beware that Hezekiah does not mislead you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his hand from the hand of the king of Syria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Parad? Are the gods of the Sepharim? And when they deliver this Samaria into from my hands, who among all the gods of these lands delivered their land from my hand, that the Lord would deliver Jerusalem from my hand? Basically, Assyria, the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, is saying, hey, look at all the lands I conquered. Nobody's been able to stop me. And if I want to do this, you can't stop me either. The problem with Sennacherib is actually pointed out in a prophecy that's mentioned earlier in Isaiah. In chapter 10, starting with verse 5, Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5, says, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff whose hand is in my indignation. I sent it against a godless nation and commissioned it against the people of my fury, to capture booty and to seize plunder, and to trample them down in the mud of the streets. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in his heart. But rather, its purpose is to destroy and to cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Canol like Carchemish? Or Hamath like Arpad? Or Samaria like Damascus? As my hand has reached into the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images are greater than the lands of Jerusalem or Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images, just as I had done to Samaria and her idols? So it will be that the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem. He will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he says, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this. For I have understanding, and I have removed boundaries of the people and plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached into the riches of the peoples like a nest. As one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth, and there is no one that flapped his wing or opened his beak or chirped. Is the axe posed to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That it would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. The Lord basically says Assyria has lost perspective. God's using Assyria to punish nations. But Assyria has gotten to the point where it thinks it's the one in control. And again, notice how often I is used, and me, and mine. The king of Assyria shows his pride and his accomplishment, his selfishness, in all those words. Sennacherib thought it was all his own doing. Going back to Isaiah 36, this down to verse 23. Oops, I got the wrong passage again. Yeah, I want 37 here. Let's go to 37, verse 23. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised your voice? And a haughty lifted up your eyes against the holy ones of Israel. Though your servants you have reproached the Lord, and you have said, with my mighty chariots I came down to the heights of the mountains, to the remotest parts of Lebanon. And I cut down all his tall cedars and his choice cypresses. I will go to his highest peak and his thickest forest. I dug wells and drank water. And with the sole of my feet, I dried up all the rivers of Egypt. Have you not heard long ago that I did it? From ancient times, I planned it. Now I have brought it to pass. You should turn fortified cities into ruined heaps. Therefore, their inhabitants were short of strength. They were dismayed and put to shame. They were as the vegetation of the field and as a green herb, as grass on the housetop is scorched before it's grown up. But I know you are sitting down, you're going out, and you're coming in, and you're raging against me. Because you're raging against me, and because your arrogance has come up to my ears, therefore I will put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. God is basically saying, you think you're doing all this? I've been directing you. The reason why you've been able to conquer all these countries, I made them weak. Sennacherib thought he was such a great thing. God says, look, I'm going to turn you around whether you want to or not. And he did turn him around. Starting with verse 36 of that same chapter, Isaiah 37, verse 36. Then the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all these were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, the Abimelech and Asherah's, his sons killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Arat. And Asheradon, his son, became king in his place. He thought he was in control. He thought he was a might. God wiped out 185,000 soldiers overnight. He goes running back home, stays there. He never leaves again for 2 years. And while he's worshiping in an idol temple, he dies at the hands of his own sons. Who was in control? But notice how Sennacherib showed his personality in all that he said. Nebuchadnezzar was a conqueror, came after Assyria. He also had the same flaw. In fact, he was even warned in advance not to go down this path. He was given a dream and a warning, but Nebuchadnezzar still found pleasure in his accomplishments. In Daniel chapter 4, starting with verse 28, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. The king reflected and said, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" While the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared sovereignty has been removed from you, and you'll be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You'll be given grass to eat like cattle. 7 time periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realms of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes." And immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. And he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of the heavens, and his hair grew like the eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. God was in control. Nebuchadnezzar started looking and saying, "Look at what I did." But God was in control. And notice again the use of I and mine. But down in verse 34, unlike Sennacherib, Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson. "But at the end of the period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of earth are counted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?' At the time, my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdoms, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, surpassing the greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true, his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride." Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson. But there's one other one we should consider, and that's the one we had in our scripture reading from Luke chapter 16. I want you to notice especially, Luke chapter 12, verse 16. But I want you especially to look and notice the use of I and my. Luke chapter 12, starting with verse 16. "And he told them a parable. The land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" What kind of man is being described here? Same type. Man who's selfish, who thinks the world revolves around him. And in his pride, he forgot how little he had control over his life. Starting with verse 20, "But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So it is with a man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. We need to understand something about what all these characters are telling us. We cannot live a life filled with pride. It leaks out in our speech. It leaks out in how we behave. We as Christians have to understand it's not the way Christ wants us to live. In 1 Peter chapter 5, and starting with verse 5. 1 Peter 5, verse 5 says, "You younger men, likewise be subject to your elders, and all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you." God does care for us, but we have to be dependent on God. When we start thinking about the world as if it revolves around us and that we have to take care of everything, and if we're not involved and somehow it's not going to get done, we lost proper perspective. We need to consider how we talk and how we write about ourselves. Think about it, the passages over in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12 and in verse 3. "For though the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God allowed it to each a measure of faith." Don't think of yourself greater than you really are. Hey, some of these people that we read about, these kings that ran Assyria and Babylon, they had some reasons to think themselves mighty. And a lot of times we, as Christians, talk about ourselves in greater terms, as if we control the world and every aspect of our lives. We need to consider even the small words that we use, the I's and the my's and the me's. We might be revealing a character that we don't desire. One last passage in Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12 and in verse 36. "But I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an account, accounting for it on the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." See, what we say when we don't think, oftentimes is what very much indicates who we are. We might not intend it, but it shows. Think about what we say. Think about how we act. And put on Christ in humility first and foremost in our lives. If there's anyone here today is not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here is a child of God, we'd like the prayers of the brethren on the rehab. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song we selected.